Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got a lot to cover this week. Apparently, the memo was sent out. I didn't receive it. But Wade, Jason, Matt are wearing collared shirts. I'm wearing an advised t-shirt. Of course, I'm also sitting in the advised corporate office. As you can see, I've reserved the conference room so that I could do the podcast here. You should come visit us when you guys are in Orlando. Visit our new corporate office. I'm on the third floor. Coffee is available 24/7 for those working after hours. So I'm here again, as always, with my compadres, Wade McFall, whatever you want to call him, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA office of HHS OIG and is now a member of our SIU investigative team, Jason Eisengrind, retired leader from the HHS OIG, the former or retired UPIC West director, and now our special director in charge on special projects and things of that sort, Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart, was also a retired HHS OIG senior executive and the retired Northeast UPIC director and is a member of our SIU investigative team as a manager. And I just checked my driver's license as I always do beforehand because sometimes I fall, smack my head, and forget who I am. I am still Eric Rubenstein, the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse. We have some great information that we're going to talk about. So first and foremost is August. We're doing a LinkedIn Live and our special guest. This is a little preview. I shouldn't be telling everybody, but we're going to be having Marshall Allen, who wrote the book, Never Pay. It's not coming up. There it is. Chroma key. It's terrible. Never pay the first bill. There it is. Never pay the first bill. Marshall Allen was a writer at ProPublica for a number of years, author. Many people know this book. We have a book club here at Advise where we're reading through it and we're chatting about it. I've read it several times. I reference it in a lot of the classes I teach. And you guys are all reading it. And it's a great book. And we're going to have Marshall on for a LinkedIn Live in August. And we're going to talk a lot about some of the things that he talks about. A little bit from a fraud, waste, abuse, compliance perspective. But, you know, there's a chapter in his book, and I'm going to open up to it. And, you know, he talks a lot about special investigations units. He talks about fraud, waste, abuse on the payer side, right? Because Marshall's whole premise is you get a bill, you shouldn't just pay it. You know, check your receipts, right? That's what he'll say. Check your receipts like anything else. You don't go to a restaurant for dinner and just pay the bill without seeing if you got charged for something that you didn't have. You know, obviously the healthcare system is unique. It's the only thing I can think of here in this country where we don't know what we're paying for until after it occurs, right? Anything else, you buy a car, there's a sticker price. Whether you pay that price or not, you at least have some idea of what the item is, right? So in this case, Marshall makes a couple of sort of assertions. One thing he talks about is, and I was talking about this, I'm coming off of page 203 of the book. He's got an area he entitles as it's just not worth it for your insurer to ferret out fraud. And so I want to talk about first from the OIG piece, right? You know, we understand that, you know, what something being worth it or not is a relative term. And Wade, I want to start with you because we're talking on the OIG side is sort of the frustrations of working on a case and vetting it and doing all of the things that we've talked about over the past few weeks from that SIU perspective. Doing all of the things that we do to work on a case. And then at the end of the day, like there's no appetite for it. And you know, you're working on things, you have a budget, it's a line item. And so the question of, you know, the juice being worth the squeeze, but here Marshall makes the, you know, that it's not really in an insurer's interest to ferret out fraud. Now, obviously from the OIG perspective, you can see that, you know, it's not in their interest to ferret out fraud because it's frustrating, right? You've got that push-pull of provider abrasion, you know, and all of that. How do you, you know, and I could see if somebody reading Marshall's book getting annoyed if they work in an SIU and just kind of say, well, maybe I'm not choosing the right path or the right career. How do you keep people engaged in the interest of the fact that an SIU is kind of a rock and a hard place, right? At the OIG, we would be the rock and a hard place. We've got U.S. attorney priorities, we've got CMS priorities, we've got agency priorities, right? One week you're being told, work all your cases as healthcare cases. The next week it's, hey, we have 20% of our money is supposed to be spent on things other than healthcare. Go find yourself a grant fraud case. And then the next week you're told, hey, don't worry about that Grand Ford case. Go back and work your healthcare cases, right? So how do you, that becomes an argument of that an SIU, that a plan, an insurer may not be interested in fighting fraud. The same thing could be said from the OIG's perspective, depending upon who you're talking to at the time, right?
Yeah, I think the main difference is probably the priorities that are set out with the OIG. We've talked about this before, but criminal convictions are like the number one priority. That's what we do. Civil recoveries are equally as important maybe, but in, as far as priority, it's always about criminal first and then civil and then administrative remedies. And I think there's less of those priorities are less clear from what I'm seeing in the SIU, where it's you have certain like workflows that you follow. So maybe this investigation you're looking at is going to turn into some type of a credible allegation of fraud, although there's less kind of delineation on what that should include as opposed to the OIG. In the OIG world, if you have a case that you think is going to be criminal, you do some legwork on it, and then you take it to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it's pretty clear they will say, okay, this is the statute we're looking at. These are the elements of that statute. In order to charge this, we're going to have to show A, B, C, D, maybe down to F, G, H, I, J, wherever. There's a lot of things that they're going to need to show before they'll charge it. And I think in the SIU world, it's really not that, it's not set up with that specificity. Say that right. But it's more than less taking the referral that you get and not doing a lot of legwork on it, where there's more legwork in the OIG world, and just kind of turning that into an allegation of fraud. And then it gets sent off per the workflow, and you probably aren't going to hear about it for months. Whereas in the OIG world, the agent is going to be meeting with the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, or whoever the prosecutor may be on a regular basis. They do some legwork, they get some work done, and they go back and report back in and make sure they're on track, make sure this is still the type of thing that the prosecutor is looking for. And it's kind of a work in progress, whereas in the SIU world, you kind of look at the referral, you make the referral, and then it's out of your hands, and it's maybe still on your docket, so to speak. So you're still following it to kind of see what's happening with it, but it may be months before you hear anything back. And typically what I'm seeing is a lot of times they may be doing work on it, but it seems like they're sitting on it, but it's out of your docket for months. And then in most cases, it comes back saying we're not interested, which can be very right. Frustrating. Very frustrating.
Well, and that's the frustrating part, Matt. I'm going to go to you a second, but one of the things that that Marshall talks about in his book, he's spoken to people about this. He talks about fraud investigators who have worked for the big insurance carriers tell me the insurers don't police fraud as much as they could because it's expensive. It's hard to prove criminal intent, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, as opposed to an honest mistake. Or maybe a doctor will claim to be doing some more novel medical treatment that's in a great area. And the issue here is that he also goes on and says, perhaps counterintuitively, is insurance companies loath to offend physicians and hospitals in their all-important networks, even those accused of wrongdoing. They attract new clients by providing access to their networks. And I think, that becomes the piece where SIUs are kind of that rock in a hard place, right? They're dealing with the payer side, they're dealing with the network, they're dealing with having to do return on investment. Many of these companies are publicly traded. And then at the end of the day, the expense comes in where if you're not making a referral to law enforcement, it's having to pursue that matter on your own, outside counsel being brought in and things of that sort. So it's almost like this argument, and I don't know if I want to make this the title of our roundtable, because I think that it's disingenuous to do it, but it's like, does SIU work even matter? So Matt, you had some things you wanted to throw in, so go ahead.
I was just going to follow up on something Wade brought up, where he said at the SIU, they make the referral, and it kind of goes into a, months long, perhaps years long, waiting period for the SIU. And then you talked about, the OIG, you're having conversations with the U.S. attorney, you're doing all of this work. are you going back to the source at that point, giving them a status? No, you're not. And that's the give and take there is, you know, you might think it's in an abyss. It's just in a black hole. The cases are being worked for the most part. You're just not getting the feedback. So from the SIU's point of view, money's going out because they can't take actions. They're not hearing anything because it's probably in some point not proper to come back and tell them about it. And so the process works against that type of referral because the OIG has a budget. You're right. And it's, you know, however it might be, all law enforcement has a budget. SIUs have bottom lines. And, you know, that type of case is going against the bottom line. Not just because of provider abrasion and you're picking on a provider, but it's because money's going out that you know is fraudulent or potentially fraudulent. You can't do anything about it. And there's no return on that. And so that's the whole give and take.
Well, and that then leads to that, you know, sort of that where you're really a rock and a hard place is that at the end of the day, the plans just want to get their money back. And when you've got something that's hung up for years in which that money is potentially still going out the door because the provider hasn't been charged or what have you, that there is certainly, I can see this reluctance for an SIU to want to make a referral or maybe water down the documentation to make it look that it's a little less ominous than it maybe is. Because if you can handle it as an internal overpayment, you're going to get that money back. And at least you've identified that this provider is a wayward provider. And then maybe you provide, you know, internally, you set up some internal structures for monitoring, right? You put them on a watch list or something like that, where you're monitoring their billings for upticks on that issue and work to do things like behavior modification. I mean, that's why, you know, I talk a lot about it in a lot of the trainings that we do is this whole targeted probe and education process where, you know, if commercial insurers began to really bring that into the fold, you would see these tectonic shifts because providers are either going to change their behavior or you're going to put them on prepay, which they don't want to do. And then while prepay is costly on the provider, on the payer side, you're at least getting this cadence going where you're letting the provider community know they just can't run slipshod. But one of the things that you brought up, Matt, I want to go to Jason is, and we talk about this ad nauseum, is the important role of a fractional law enforcement liaison. And fractional is the new catchphrase for part-time or PRN or per diem or as needed. Because for many of these instances, it doesn't need to be a 40-hour-a-week job, depending upon how you're going to narrowly or broadly define the position. And Jason, I think, you know, we've talked about this a million times. At your UPIC, UPIC West, you and UPIC Southwest got together and you basically brought somebody in. And on the medic side, there actually is somebody in that role to kind of help to facilitate it. And it was you for a while, I know that, but then you brought in a retired HHS OIG person to kind of help be that face. The medic does it. It's not a bad idea, right? I mean, you can really, at the end, save man hours, streamline effort, and keep those lines of communication going.
Absolutely. So, and maybe you'll admit to it or not, but I actually spoke to you about your interest in that role when, you know, after you leaving HHS OIG. So having someone that can understand what's of value to the OIG, FBI, state law enforcement agencies, whatever it is, it's a huge mitigation to the outlay of spending a lot of time on something that then turns out to be of little or no interest or value to those federal and state law enforcement agencies. So, and of course, it's always about communication. So, you know, but I do have another point, and I apologize about the mixed metaphor, but taking what you said about not, you know, paying the bill at the restaurant without examining it first. First, I'll adopt that now when I'm lunch on Advisor's Dime to make sure I look at it. I wasn't looking at it before, but I will now. But the second thing is that the beneficiaries, members, patients, whatever the right terminology is for the person that's getting the medical service, it's very clear that they are the gatekeepers. And for a long time, I've wondered why there wasn't a more interactive process for the person receiving those services to be part of the validation of those services. And the government has done a very good job with 1-800-MEDICARE and other communication platforms for people to report. But the fact of the matter is most people are not looking at their explanation of benefits or, you know, the receipts as they were called before, because they're not probably paying much of anything of that bill. So I've often thought, why isn't there like a rewards program or something for the number of times you've, you know, validated what's on that statement? Because it is the greatest source of information is right there. I mean, they, you know, some services will cause some confusion and they won't remember, well, did I have a 50-minute long E&M versus a 5-minute long E&M? Sure, those things might actually even cause some, you know, waste of time, if you will. But the reality is they'll know whether they got a paraffin wax bath. They'll know whether they got a power wheelchair, things of that nature. So, you know, the fact of the matter is a much better job is needed on getting information from the recipient of those services. So having said all that, I will just say that we can provide services that would help understand what's of interest to OIG and law enforcement. And the times that I've been involved in that now, it has added a great dimension to that part of the operation.
Well, you know, you say something that's pretty interesting, and I know, and we've had conversations with some of our payer clients about this, is changing the explanation of benefits statements that patients get to be more descriptive so people understand them. So for an example, we do work for claims that are processed by a third-party administrator for a self-insured for their ambulance claims. And I do, specifically, I do a lot of their very specific reviews where they have a provider that they want to deny a claim for, where it was like a BLS, basic life support emergency, but it's really a non-scheduled, non-routine call. And having been an EMT for 30 years and having done some ambulance cases, you know, I read through these call sheets and identify whether or not, you know, based on the CMS policies regarding 911 or equivalent and the like. And I've gone back to the third party administrator and I've said, the easiest thing would be for there to be something other than a HCPCS code and something that says transport. Something to be a more descriptor of this. And I know I've had numbers of conversations over the years with different insurers, number of conversations with insurers about this. And it seems to me like that could be one of the easiest things to do, is make the bill easily readable by the lay public. I mean, we're all professionals that have been in this space for, you know, 30, 40 years plus, and we have a hard time looking at these bills and understanding what they say and then deciphering all of the things that are in those bills. So, I mean, that seems like an easy step that people could take. I mean, remember, when Medicare was created in 1965, when they threw in the 20%, part of that reason was to give the Medicare population skin in the game. I mean, when you have a plan in which your copay is $10, the copay isn't really, I mean, it's a de minimis amount of money for some people. And so the copay isn't really to offset the cost of that care, because you're already, the health insurance company is already paying $500 for that service. That $10 is not necessarily making a huge difference. It's skin in the game. But I think, you know, the point you've made, Jason, which is right, is that as time has gone on, people have just become acclimated to these things. And whether it be through waivers of copays where they don't care, you know, I remember working on podiatry cases where waiver of copays were going on. And I would say to the patient, well, why do you go to them? And they'd say, well, because it's free. It's free, right? It's not really free. You're paying for it indirectly. But, you know, it is a thing. But I want to close this out because one of the things that Marshall talks about, and we're going to have him on, and I think, you know, we're going to talk a lot more about this now that we're all kind of reading his book, is the fact that he talks about the lack of criminal prosecution of cases. And he cites some statistics out of California and referrals from Mufuku to prosecutors' offices and things of that sort. And I won't bore you with details of that, but he basically talks about the fact that, you know, the health insurers are probably not pursuing the criminal prosecution of fraud. And he cites in some of his analysis, some empirical information that he got from talking to prosecutors at Mufuku's and in the state of California in Los Angeles County. But he's also talking a lot about the fact that there's a high cost to prosecuting, to moving these cases on. And the fact that, you know, if you're going to spend your time looking for the criminal fraud, you're limited, right? SIUs are limited. They don't have the ability to swear out warrants. They don't have the ability to take oaths. A lot of them don't have the ability to take written statements. They don't have subpoena authority, search warrant authority. And so there's a limit to how much they can possibly do to be able to get to a case that can be, you know, identified as a fraud case. So wait, I want to give you the last bit on this, because you're sitting at one of our SIU clients and you're interacting with the commercial space, the Medicaid space. You're interacting with putting together referrals for law enforcement. And I know from talking to you that there's this frustration, because there is this, you know, do we make this referral? Do we not make this referral? And, you know, that fear that when you make a referral to law enforcement, you basically are told stand down and the case sits and the money churns. And so, you know, on a day-to-day, how do you reconcile figuring out, you know, am I spending all of my time trying to make a criminal referral? Am I making all of my time trying to make an overpayment referral, or that balance? And I'm sure it becomes a little bit of a psychotherapy session amongst yourself about which path to go on.
Yeah, and I think it's important too. Probably all the different MCOs or SIUs have similar kind of goals and focuses, but they probably all differ somewhat. So that's really the game, is to try and figure out like a percentage of, you know, how much time should I be spending working on a criminal referral versus recoveries. And I think there's some cases that come in, just the criminal investigator in me, it's like, I can't just take this, you know, look at this just as trying to make a recovery. I have to do something if it's, you know, somewhat egregious. And there's a, you know, you look at these different elements. If it's egregious, if it's a repeat offender, this person has already been through this repaying overpayments before and they just went back to doing the same thing. Okay, maybe it's there's an element of it proving intent in that. So now I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe this is criminal because he or she knows that they've done this before and they had to pay it back, so they know it's wrong. And so if you have those types of things, I still feel like, even though it's maybe not the top priority and for the SIU, and they're looking strictly at numbers and they're comparing people who are bringing back more numbers, but I still feel like those types of cases, if they have that kind of criminal element to them, and because of the history of the provider, I still think that we're like doing a disservice if we don't make those referrals, even though that if it's say it's $100,000 overpayment, I'm not going to be able to claim that as an overpayment. But if it really needs to be a criminal referral in the bigger scheme of things, then I think it's important for investigators to realize that. And that maybe go back to what Jason says, that may be like having the experience of a law enforcement liaison to try and kind of help with those decisions. But again, I think if there's certain elements of a case, it's like the right thing to do a criminal referral versus just recouping the money.
Right. Hey, well, I think go ahead, Jason.
Just one more thing, as the great TV detective Columbo would say. So the process is just not binary. It's not law enforcement referral, single damage, overpayment. It's a sliding scale. So everything we're speaking about here is about case management, supervision, and having someone who is able to, because investigators, auditors, they want to chew that bone until there isn't any meat on it any longer. Whether that's in line with the organizational's goal, it's got to be up to someone who has, you know, the organizational perspective.
Right. And I think that, and Matt, I'll turn to you for the last word in a second, but I think the point of this, my take home, is investigators are always looking to see where they can find the next rock to look under. The problem is that there may not be another rock to look under, but you're constantly looking for it. And I think where that balance is, and that law enforcement liaison or that person is to maybe be that external but internal voice of reason to say, hey, you've done everything that you could possibly do within the purview of your day, and there are no other rocks that you can turn over. So let's take a look at what these facts and circumstances are and see, does this need to be referred to law enforcement? And how can I, as the law enforcement liaison, communicate the importance of that to that organization, or to that law enforcement organization, or make the pitch to say to that law enforcement organization, hey, look, we're working on this case. We don't think this is worth your time and effort. But it's really, you know, it's that investigators always are looking. It is a dog with a bone, right? So it's always trying to find that other rock that just may not be there, right? It's waiting for something that hasn't happened. Matt, final words.
Just a couple things. One is to follow up on the law enforcement liaison. You're right. It's two-way communications. You know, that law enforcement liaison perhaps can convince the law enforcement agency that, hey, these are the priorities of the organization that's referring you cases. So can they take those actions and not compromise your case? Instead of it going into the void, there is the back and forth and some agreement as to actions that can be taken as the investigation goes on. The second thing I want to say is, you know, Marshall's saying SIUs, are they worth it? You know, perhaps in their traditional tip of the spear, all we do is get money back or refer, there's some question there. But, you know, the advised work group, we're trying to redefine what an SIU does and make it more of an integral part of the entire operation of the payer, so that, you know, some of the work we do impacts everything from enrollment to claims adjudication to provider outreach to all of that. Work better with those groups as an integral part of it, and the work of the SIU can then have an overall ROI benefit to the organization, separate and apart from just the dollars and cents that come back on an overpayment.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, one of the things that I will always say is, if you're going to pitch a case on something, one of the things that I think is always a great selling point is your provider may be, you know, one unique provider, but you can go and say, hey, look, we've identified $100,000 in overpayments for this provider. We think it's a case that you should take. And by the way, we've identified $1 million in the overall, you know, hey, providers are starting to bill for electrical stimulation of the left ear. This is the first guy that we're working on, but we have found $13 million in other payments. And you kind of, you know, you want to create a little bit of a buildup of excitement about the fact, hey, look, this is the first one that's like this, but there's more to it. And I think that's one of the things that the working group is working on, a lot of things that are in that vein, like it's getting these benchmarks and these level yep. sets. So, you know, look, there's a lot. We're working through the book ourselves. We've got our book club going on. We're going to be chatting about these things. You know, Marshall makes a lot of great points. They are all about, you know, paying the bill, but I'm looking at it as a fraud, waste, abuse guy, as you guys are. We're looking at it from this other angle. And I think there's a lot more to it. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up the next few weeks. We've got a packed agenda for the next few weeks. We're going to be talking about lawsuits that come about as a result of providers having been acquitted of their criminality. And there's some lawsuits out there about that. So we're going to talk about that. We've got Marshall Allen in August. It's packed. For those of you that are going to be out at NAMPI, National Association of Medicaid Provider Integrity, that is going to be the end of July, beginning of August, out in Arizona. If you're going to be there, please connect up with us. We'd love to talk to you about some of the things that you all are seeing in the Medicaid space. If you're not getting our newsletter, again, please sign up for it. Hello at advise@advizehealth.com. As always, we appreciate your time. Follow us on LinkedIn, catch us on YouTube, catch us on Spotify. And next week, we will see you guys for another great episode. Matt, Jason, Wade, always good seeing you guys. Come to the office, come visit me in the conference room.